how SpaceX became a rocket launching giant, and one scientist's journey into space. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. From reusable rockets to launching astronauts to the International Space Station, SpaceX has changed the space industry in just a little over two decades. And that journey is documented in space editor and journalist Eric Berger's newest book, Reentry. We'll speak with Berger about the book, SpaceX's history and its possible future, and how company founder Elon Musk may pose a challenge for that next chapter. Then one Florida scientist took his work to the edge of space in Blue Origin's New Shepard capsule. University of Florida's Rob Furl is now back on Earth after his mission. We'll speak with Furl about his trip to the edge of space and how he became the first NASA-funded university research to conduct his own experiment, and what this means for the future of space-based research. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Founded in 2002, SpaceX has quickly become a top contributor to the space industry in only about two short decades.
Three, two, one. Engines full power and liftoff. Crew 6, go Dragon, go Falcon.
From developing reusable rockets to launching astronauts to the International Space Station, SpaceX has had a lot of accomplishments. That success came around pivotal moments in the company's history. Moments chronicled in a new book, Reentry, by Eric Berger, space editor and journalist at Ars Technica. Eric joins us now to talk about those pivotal moments and the next chapters of SpaceX. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks very much. Great to be back, Brennan.
Hey, Eric, last time we talked about a book you wrote, it was your first book, Liftoff. This new book, Reentry, it looks at a new generation of SpaceX. Tell me a bit about the difference between the kind of scrappy engineers you introduced us to in your first book to these engineers that are working on Falcon 9 and the reentry of the vehicle.
Yeah, well, it's funny. You know, when I got into reporting it, one of the things that surprised me is at least for the first half of the 2010s, that scrappy mentality just carried forward. They were just still under extreme pressure in terms of finances. The company was at risk of going under. They were kind of getting money in at the beginning of the month, and by the end of the month, it was all gone. You know, they had a couple of failures in the middle in 2015 and 2016. It was really painful for them. So it's not really until you get to the end of the 2010s where this is kind of a maturing company that can start to breathe a little bit easier financially. So they were very scrappy, especially in like the first half of the 2010s. I say, you know, site reconstruction for launch pads, you know, might cost $200 to $400 million, and they built like 40 back for $20 million, for example.
That's wild. How do they do something like that?
Well, you know, they scavenge a lot of parts. So one of the funniest things to me in the book is that SpaceX had a couple of engineers that would go around all the old launch pads and search for scrap metal or old tanks or pressure vessels that they could use. And the Air Force kind of got so familiar with them, they started calling them Sanford and Son after the junk dealers on the old TV show.
That's like, it's so wild to think, and that was like, what, only 14, 15 years ago, you know, this company that is dominating in the space industry was literally pulling parts off of old launch infrastructure to make new launch pads. That's a pretty wild development, isn't it?
It was really kind of the fact that they were under, you know, really severely under-resourced. You know, they did not have huge government contracts at the time. No one was really paying them to do a lot of this stuff, especially with building up the launch site. So they were, you know, saving money wherever possible. You know, the original director of the launch site in Florida said that at one point Elon asked if they could save money by not using rebar in the concrete. So those are the kind of things that they were into.
You said that they were under-resourced, but did you ever think that they were underestimated during that time?
Oh, yes. They were vastly underestimated throughout the whole period of the 2010s. And in one sense, that's one of the major themes of reentry is kind of how all of its competitors 10 to 15 years ago looked down their noses at SpaceX, right? You had United Launch Alliance, you had Boeing, you had Roscosmos, you had the European Space Agency and Arianespace, and Blue Origin even to some extent. All of these companies kind of looked at SpaceX as these upstarts with a big talking CEO that were going to fall flat on their faces. And then everything that they were trying, well, that was never going to work. And then when, of course, they launched the Falcon 9, well, it was never going to land, and just kind of went on and on from there until you got to a couple really key touchstone moments. You know, in 2018, when you had the Falcon Heavy launch and the two side boosters landing, people really were shocked, I think, to see that happen. And I think the real touchstone moment was the Demo 2 mission when they launched people into space. And, you know, NASA had been waiting and waiting for this. And all of a sudden, it was not Boeing, but SpaceX that really gave the U.S. Space Agency coveted most, which was basically getting its people into space.
Stepping back a little bit, Eric, first, you know, how many SpaceX employees do you estimate you've interviewed for this book? And do you see some kind of through lines between what their motivations were in those early days, the late 2000s and early 2010s?
Yeah, I probably talked to almost 100 people for the book, primarily former employees. And their motivations were quite varied. Some came to SpaceX because it was the most challenging thing they could think of doing in their industry. Like if they wanted to be working on the cutting edge of the possible, this was it. A lot of them had actually interned at NASA and had seen how working at the space agency was a lot of meetings and oftentimes working in programs that might get canceled. And so SpaceX was an opportunity to go work on hardware that was going to fly, you know, as soon as humanly possible. I think that appealed to people. And a lot of people also had a recognition that, especially as you get later in the 2010s, that working at SpaceX was pretty much the highest apex job you could have, and that if you went through that crucible, you know, everyone understood if you're going to go there, you're going to work super long hours, work super hard in a very demanding environment. But if you came through that, then you could start your own company or go work for another aerospace company. It just would really be about the best possible thing you could put on your resume.
You mentioned some touchstone moments, 2018 Falcon Heavy, 2020's Demo 2. What about that moment when we heard Falcon has landed? That first landing of Falcon 9, how big of a moment was that for SpaceX?
That was probably the most important moment in the company's history. I have a lot of fondness for the first Falcon 1 launch because that saved the company. But I think the Falcon 9 landing in December of 2015 was a super critical moment, because if you think back about half a year earlier, they'd had their first failure of the Falcon 9 rocket with the CRS-7 second stage exploding in flight. It was their first failure in 7 years, and most of the people at the company had never experienced failure. And so they had the whole trauma of dealing with that and returning to flight with a Falcon 9 rocket. And then if you look at all the other things that they were doing too for that mission, it's pretty insane, because they were at that time, they were going from Falcon 1.1 to Falcon 9 full thrust. And this was the first time they were using densified propellant on the rocket. That was a huge change in terms of the ground infrastructure needed to make the super chilled liquid oxygen, because you couldn't buy that stuff anywhere. You had to manufacture it, and no one had ever manufactured it outside of like a laboratory. Like they were having to manufacture it at scale, and they were having to manage it on the rocket and this whole new process of filling the vehicle, you know, loading and going. And then that was also like they had attempted some ocean landings, but they'd never tried to land on land before. And it was this whole process to get approval from the FAA and especially the Air Force, the range to land a couple miles away from cruise facilities. The National Reconnaissance Office has this huge, you know, multi-billion-dollar processing facility, and they were concerned about noise from the rocket destroying the satellites that they were working on, just all of these hurdles. So you packed all of that into this launch a couple of days before Christmas in 2015, and this really intense 6-month period to get back to flight, trying densified propellant, landing the rocket for the first time, upgrading to a brand new version of the rocket. And it all came together on this night. And it was just kind of this magical moment that I think for a lot of employees there really crystallized that, yeah, this was going to be possible, that they had taken this pivotal step toward reusing rockets.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Eric Berger, senior space editor and journalist at Ars Technica, about his new book, Reentry, that talks about SpaceX's journey from a startup company to a successful aerospace leader. As someone who has followed the program for as long as you had at that moment, and also for someone who I'm sure is a cynical journalist, did you think that they were going to make it in 2015, make that landing?
I kind of thought they would. But I really didn't know. I mean, if you had watched the ocean landings, they'd gotten fairly close. And for a couple of years at that point, they were able to bring the rocket down. It was just they'd always had some kind of problem with the stability of the ocean ship or the hydraulic fluid. And so I thought it was maybe like a 50-50 chance. But it is pretty funny, you know, going back and talking to this SpaceX people and the Air Force, like no one really knew what that sonic boom type reentry right over the Cape, whether that was going to be really destructive. And there was legitimately lots of concern. The Air Force did this huge report where basically like super cautious saying, you know, we can't possibly let this happen because X, Y, and Z. And SpaceX provided some data that gave the head of the range a little bit of confidence. But, you know, it's funny that there really was no damage. Like SpaceX had this kind of ratty old trailer parked at the, you know, the landing site with these cheap plastic windows, and like, you know, even those didn't break, right? So it's like it was a pretty harmless reentry profile. But no, I wasn't confident. I mean, how could you be?
And I should clarify, I'm not saying you particularly are a cynical journalist, just journalists in general are cynical. I didn't mean to offend.
Not offended at all.
So, let's switch gears a little bit. In chapter 11 of this book, it talks about the decision for NASA and commercial crew and how it almost wasn't SpaceX and just Boeing alone. And thinking about, you know, this week, SpaceX is attempting to send a crew of just two to the space station to bring back the Starliner astronauts. Tell me a bit about that decision. What if that decision wasn't made?
Yeah, it's really wild in retrospect because it was almost 10 years ago to the day where all of the human spaceflight poobahs basically at NASA get together in a room and kind of make the decision on, you know, from among Boeing, SpaceX, and Sierra Nevada, who to entrust the commercial crew program with. And from my retelling of this meeting, it's quite clear that almost the entire room just wanted to give all the money to Boeing. And Boeing had been lobbying for a while to say, we can do this, but we're going to need all of the funding and you should give it to us because we're the only company you can really trust. And that argument held sway with pretty much everyone in that room until it got to Phil McAllister, who was like the last person to speak before Bill Gerstenmaier made the decision. And so, yeah, it's pretty crazy to think about how history would have been different, right? Because if Boeing had been the sole contractor, I think they probably would have felt even less urgency than they did with the commercial crew program. And so, yeah, we probably would have been in a situation where Russia invades Ukraine and, you know, then how our astronauts get to the space station becomes this huge geopolitical decision and tension point.
Yeah, it is an interesting what if to think about. Eric, I want to finish our conversation at the start of this book. In the prologue of your book, you talk about the launch of Starship, the next chapter in SpaceX, in SpaceX's story. What is the next chapter for SpaceX? What are you going to write about next is what I'm asking. Because inevitably you're going to write another book, right, Eric?
I will take a little bit of a break here. You know, I think it's really an interesting question. And I think it's in some senses a political question because Elon Musk has been essential to the success of SpaceX for the last 20 years. I mean, he's certainly made some mistakes and I talk about him in the book. But, you know, by and large, he has steered that ship in a direction. And I don't think it's no secret, right, in the commercial space industry that SpaceX has thrived where a lot of other companies have struggled. I think you have to mark that down to his leadership at the end of the day. So as he becomes more entwined politically, speaking out much more and alienating, you know, large sections of this country and international partners, I think that really complicates things in terms of the company's future. And that's a real wild card, and I think where SpaceX is going. But, you know, that's a quite big bit of uncertainty. But in general, I think it's pretty clear, like Elon and the company's focus is on Starship becoming a success. And if that rocket, you know, is even half as successful as they're trying to make it, it completely changes the industry, you know, in terms of launch costs. You know, they're not going to be as low as SpaceX says, but they will be in terms of dollar per kilogram to orbit, they're going significantly down. And in terms of the size of spacecraft that you can build, you know, it's just no comparison. Like the Apollo program, if they had taken the Apollo lunar module and turned that into a cargo lander, that could take, you know, about 5 tons to the lunar surface. They never did that, of course. So they just sort of crammed everything in there. But if you took a Starship and just did cargo only one way, it's 200 tons to the lunar surface. So it opens up this incredible potential for humans to do things in space, for satellites, for deep space probes. And again, that future is really hard to see, you know, but that clearly is where the company is going. And I just don't know. It could be like completely revolutionary. It could kind of just be like a bigger, better Falcon Heavy. We'll have to see.
We've been speaking with Eric Berger. He's the senior space editor at Ars Technica. His new book is Reentry, SpaceX, Elon Musk, and the Reusable Rockets that Launched a Second Space Age. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, one professor's journey into space.
Somehow that deep darkness of the void of space really, really takes your breath away in every sort of compound emotional way you can think.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. University of Florida Distinguished Professor and Assistant Vice President for Research, Rob Furrell, is back on the ground after his flight to the edge of space aboard a New Shepard capsule last month.
Two, one. space.
Forel made his journey from West Texas to beyond the boundary of space, where he experienced microgravity and viewed the Earth from a new perspective. But it wasn't just a joyride for Forel. He conducted an experiment that could one day help scientists better understand how humans can thrive in space for long-duration space missions. And while he's still analyzing the data, Forel made some time to join us and talk about his mission and what this means for the future of space-based research. Well, Rob, welcome back to the show, but more importantly, welcome back to Earth after your trip to space.
Oh, yeah. Listen, thank you for welcoming me back. And yeah, the whole notion of being welcomed back from space is pretty crazy, right? It's just plain crazy. So yeah, thanks.
So tell me about it, Rob. I mean, we had you on a few weeks before your flight. Before we get into the actual launch itself, take us to like T-minus 2 days, 1 day before your launch. What was it like?
Ah, boy, that's an excellent question and really gets at the heart of a lot of the things associated with, you know, launching to space or in fact, launching any sort of big scale, large planning. Couldn't wait to have it happen, delayed, but it's still going to happen. And it actually starting to get real kind of thing. That's exactly what it was like. We've been planning this for years. It was quiet, non-public for years. Then the crew got announced, then it became public. And then as we got closer to actual flight time, the stresses, the logistics planning, the everything else that leads up to those, you know, L-minus 2 days began to get real. I can't tell you how many times we bought tickets to fly out there and then changed them and then hoped that they would still work. By the time it's L-minus 2 days, you're out there and it's beginning to get very real. I think that's the most important thing to think about is that you're thinking about everything except actually fly until that 2 days ahead of time.
Let's talk about the moment you're strapped in, you're counting down hours, minutes, seconds until that engine below you fires. What was it like in that capsule? And then tell me about the ride uphill.
If one was to ever think very deeply about what it might be like to sit on top of a rocket and look out the window and wait for it to launch, you might wonder about how anxious you might be or how worried you might be or something like that. But I have to tell you, before launch was among the more serene experiences I've ever had. It's quiet. Yeah, the rocket's making some noises as the fuel's being loaded and things are being checked, but by and large, you're quiet. One is quiet with their own thoughts, looking out the window. You got to sit there quiet, you got to sit there still, and you got to come to grips with the idea that you're actually now ever closer, but really, really going to do it. I found it to be, yeah, serene and filled with both awe of anticipation, but also incredible gratitude for getting ready to experience the flight. You asked about the ride uphill. Wow, that was one of the more unexpected, but unexpectedly wonderful and nice parts about the flight. It was smooth. Liftoff was almost unrecognizable, except for the bright yellow glow of the rocket engine firing. The departure was smooth and simple. Ride all the way up through the clouds and then on into the increasingly darker sky was again smooth. And the incredible difference for all of us that have ridden airplanes, we're used to going through clouds and going up, but not vertically. And 2 to 3 G's on the way up, yeah, you feel them, definitely. But it's not sudden, it's smooth. And by the time you're racing straight uphill at 2,600 miles an hour, you don't know you're going that fast. Things are so big and the sky is so black, you just don't know you're headed up.
We talked a bit about, before you launched, about mentally preparing yourself for what you were going to see, what you were going to experience. You talked about that ever-increasing blackness of the sky. And I've heard people recall seeing the, you know, Earth against that deep, dark black having such a profound impact on them. What was that moment like for you? Did you have that overview effect moment of seeing our planet from a much different perspective than only a handful of people have seen?
The simple answer is yes. But that fails to capture the drama, the dramatic nature, the sort of all-inclusive, how can this possibly be feeling of staring into deep space. I talked to a number of close friends and astronauts that have had various kinds of experiences like this, including being up in space, I was encouraged to look up at least as much as I looked down. But that was so easy because that's what drew my attention. And it did so to the point where, and I struggle to describe it, but in some way or another, my consciousness actually leaked out through my eyeballs and went somewhere else. For that period of time, I knew I was there. I was doing what I needed to do. But somehow that deep darkness of the void of space really, really takes your breath away in every sort of compound emotional way you can think.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Rob Furrell, University of Florida Distinguished Professor and Assistant Vice President for Research, about his journey to space in a New Shepard capsule and how his experience and experiment is helping scientists better understand how humans live and thrive in space. Rob, do you have a different perspective when you looked down upon the planet because of your background as a scientist and a biologist and seeing how complex our planet is, but just how fragile it looks from that perspective?
I think that all is true, and I think would be true for anybody, whether you're a scientist or not. But I can reflect on a couple of things that truly caught my attention in that regard. One was, and many people have talked about this, is how truly thin the atmosphere is. The blackness of space, that incredible emptiness of color, contrasts so dramatically with the atmosphere, that contrast is what catches my attention more than the fragility of the Earth, potentially. That there is a fragility to Earth and that the atmosphere is so thin. Yes, as a scientist, I could bring that into my head. I could understand that. It took a split second to realize that. But I think there's something deeper than appreciating that fragile nature of the Earth, and something different than the overview effect that happens as well. Getting back to your question about as a scientist, I think one of the things that going to space did for me, has done for me, and should do to more scientists, quite honestly, if they get the chance, is give them the opportunity to understand what space is and does to biology. And I've used metaphors like this in the past, but imagine being an oceanographer that's never been out to sea, or a forester that's never gone in and touched a tree. Imagine being a space biologist that has never experienced space. So I also believe that for scientists and for anybody that goes there, one develops a deeper understanding of what space is. Now, is that represented by that stark contrast between the blackness of space and the atmosphere? Is it an understanding that comes because one is floating free in a very gentle, incredible environment? Is it because one is that far separated from the rest of everything that we know and love? Probably a little of all of those things.
Rob, we talked about the last time about what you aim to get with this scientific experiment that you took with you, because this was not just a joyride for you. You were up there to conduct science. Did you get what you set out to accomplish with the experiment?
Yeah, let me take you on that ride for a little bit. because when I said that the experience sort of sucked the brains right out of my head, I wasn't kidding. One of the first questions I asked when I got back to the ground, and as I asked myself as I looked at my experiment that I was carrying, did I do everything I was supposed to do? Where was my memory? Where was my memory? The real answer to your question is yeah. We got everything done that we wanted to do. The months that we put into planning paid off. The months that we put into simulations and training paid off. My work with psychologists on how to prepare mentally to be sure that there was enough training in my head that no matter what happened to my brain, I would still be able to get stuff done. The choreography between ground control communications and the capsule, all of those things contributed to a really, I think, in the end, well-designed approach that allowed me, yes, to get my sampling done at the right periods of time during the flight, that allowed me some personal time to look out the window and have the experience that it ought to be, But that's a long way to answering your question. Yeah, we got it done. We really did.
I had no doubt, Rob. I had no doubt. Finally, Rob, I want to just end our conversation with you mentioned that, you know, you wish more scientists get this perspective. But this flight for you is laying the groundwork for more scientists to do these kind of experiments in space. Now that you've done it, how do you see the future of space-based investigations going from here? Will there be more people like Rob Ferrell going to space?
Boy, there should be. And there's absolutely no reason why there shouldn't be. It is doable with, yeah, a serious investment in time, but not like changing your career to become a career NASA scientist. No, it can be done within the academic time frames of our world. It can be done on the commercial side by scientists that need work done for a commercial application. Science is doable inside the New Shepard capsule. I'm sure it's doable inside other commercial vehicles. Are there things yet to be done? Capsule modifications potentially, or procedural modifications that can allow more to be done? Sure, this is the beginning. But the bottom line is that absolutely there should be, and if I had a way to make it happen, I would say there should be dedicated science flights where six scientists spend a collective time doing their science on a flight. Absolutely.
What about five scientists and one science journalist? Could we make that happen?
I will tell you that we should, because the telling, as you can tell, the telling of the story is such an important part of getting stuff done, of getting science done, of getting the word out there. But yeah. Absolutely. Journalists should come along. An anthropologist should come along. All of the kinds of things that allow us as scientists or as astronauts even to tell our story the best we can and as broadly as we can. Yeah, we need that too.
Sounds good. Well, you know, I'd volunteer. So we're speaking with Rob Ferrell, University of Florida, distinguished professor and assistant vice president for research about his trip to space in Blue Origin's New Shepard capsule. Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. Aren't we there yet? AWTY, get it? And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. We are we there yet at cfpublic.org. More space coverage online, visit cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Jenna Weiss. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.